This is WHTC Money Matters, the show that dispels the myths, unravels the mysteries, and explains in plain language the world of investing, as well as brings you strong, common-sense financial guidelines for life. The opinions expressed in this show are for general information only and are not intended to give advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investment or investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your accountant, attorney, financial advisor, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered by LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. And now, from the Cooley Godfrey Investment Group in downtown Zeeland, here are your hosts, Carrie Cooley and Brent Kerwacker.
And good morning, Western Michigan. Welcome to Money Matters on the Saturday morning. This is your host, Carrie Cooley.
And Brent Kerwacker. Today's show, we're going to be talking about really kind of the 10 things you should know about Social Security.
We always get a lot of listeners and clients asking about Social Security, and we thought this would just be good to point out these things that we all should know about Social Security.
Yeah, it's obviously the area where people have the most questions. And leading into that, we're not going to begin advertising this quite yet because it's a ways away. But if for some reason you're listening and you do want to pre-sign up, we've had some sign-ups already. We're going to have our annual Social Security workshop on September 26. It's going to be a 6:30 p.m. at Port 393 in Holland. Way more to come on that as we close in on that date. Hey, Carrie, let's take a look at how markets wrapped up the week.
For the week, the markets finished as follows. The S&P 500 finished up 2.48%, the Dow up 0.53%, the NASDAQ up 3.95%, and the U.S. aggregate bond market down 0.02%. Hey, listeners, we will be right back with more Money Matters after this short break.
And welcome back, listeners. This is Money Matters on this Saturday morning. And Brent, we're going to be talking about things in the news.
Yeah, just some things from the past week. And Carrie, you talk about stamps a lot. You use it to talk about inflation. I've heard rumors you used to be a collector of stamps, which falls under alternative investments. So way to go with diversification. But let's start with the U.S. stamp. What's changing there?
Well, if you go all the way back to 1980, a postage stamp was 15 cents. And as we know, over the years, it has gradually gone up. And the Postal Service recently filed that April 9, they filed notice to increase the price again of the first class stamp from 68 cents to 73 cents. So from 1980, it was 15 to 2024, it's now it's going to be 73 cents. I think email's looking more cost effective than the actual mail.
Yeah, I can't say I send much out personally via mail these days. We do at the business, you know, at our practice, we still use the mail quite frequently. But as a home consumer user, pay everything online these days. You don't put checks in the mail like you used to. Well, you don't send letters like you used to. Everything is just so much more electronic.
Yeah.
Maybe less impersonal. I don't know. But with that being said.
But it's also cost savings. I mean, this is the second increase this year and the fourth since 2023.
They got to pay the bills.
I know. It's a 33% increase over the last 4 years.
That's a big increase. Definitely a big increase.
Okay. Talk about inflation, right?
There we go. So quarter one earnings are well underway. And obviously, we're actually almost through April already, so a lot of businesses have already reported. But 64% of companies have already beat the consensus analyst earnings per share estimates, so that is really good. And additionally, 62% beat the consensus sales estimates, so much stronger quarter than analysts expected, which is good for the market. Obviously, markets have had a strong first quarter. Little bumpy April, without question, but this week thus far, we've seen some positive days again.
Let's talk about, this is called buying the dips, and me need some help in going through this. Since 1993, when the S&P 500 exchange traded fund, and we're not recommending this, this is just an example and some news here. Since 1993, the S&P 500 ETF began trading a strategy of only owning the exchange traded fund on the day after 1% plus up days, it would have resulted in a cumulative price decline of 49%. So on the day after a 1% up day, they bought it and the price declined 49%. The opposite strategy, owning the SPY on the day after a 1% down day, would have resulted in a price gain of 350%.
I wish we had time to trade like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that... so,
but yeah, I mean, 1% up days and down days, those are far and few between. Usually you'll see, you know, somewhere under 101% in a day's gain or loss. But that's interesting. Interesting. So if you bought on a 1% up day, you'd be down 49%. If you buy on a 1% down day, up 350%.
I know.
That's a big difference.
That is a big difference.
And that's where just systematic purchases like 401ks, simple IRAs, where you're just putting it in every week. Yeah, you're increasing the odds of buying on dips.
So yes, yes.
Always a good strategy. Okay, this is just interesting little tidbit of news here. Since the year 2000, again, we're talking S&P 500 again, since the year 2000, most of the S&P 500's April gains actually tend to occur in the second half of the month, which just happens to be after tax filing date. So I don't know if that's a coincidence. People are focused on taxes the first 15 days of the month, and then they get back into the markets. I don't know. But on average, from April 15 through the remainder of the month, since the year 2000, the S&P 500 has, on average, gained 1.35% the last 2 weeks of April. Interesting fact.
It is. You know, recently, Brent, you and I talked about an article that we read on small businesses. You know, we hear that the Fed and inflation is kind of being sticky right now, has been the phrase that's been used in the news. But they're looking at everything in the economy. But let's look at, you know, the article we read was on small business. And small business, the way people are feeling in the small business world in the U.S., has hit its lowest level since December of 2012. So small business owners are not feeling very positive right now is what that is saying. And it's currently in the bottom fourth percentile of all monthly readings since 1986. Inflation was a problem, was the number one problem of a quarter of small businesses polled. So interesting. We see a lot of slowdown in the small business, but...
Well, small businesses have to borrow a lot from banks and non-banking sources just due to their size. So they need leverage to grow, help fund the business. And interest rates are way more expensive now than they were a couple years ago. And that really can sour the sentiment of small business owners when they're feeling the pinch there. So I get it. Let's see here. We're going to talk a little bit of just inflation fact. This is interesting. The U.S. Consumer Price Index, which if you listen to the news, they call it CPI. It's a measure of inflation experienced by consumers. It rose 11.4% in the 2 years leading up to the Fed's interest rate hiking cycle. And the interest rate hiking cycle began in March of 2022. Yeah. Amazing. 2 years ago already. Time just flies.
I know.
Flies.
It does.
But the 2 years leading up to the first rate hike, inflation jumped up 11.4%. And then in the 2 years since the start of the interest rate hiking cycle, it rose another 8.6. So over 4 years, we saw about a 20% increase in costs that consumers had to account for. Now, what we should add into that, though, wages grew a lot over that time, probably more than any other period, because there was such a job shortage. People were able to quit a job without having another job lined up because they knew the next day they could find a job somewhere else. And employers had no choice but to just start paying more to keep people. So thankfully, while inflation was occurring, a lot of people were also getting pay raises.
Yeah, that is very true.
Otherwise, how do you cover a 20% increase in expenses?
I know.
You just can't.
Especially, I mean, you and I talked about it often. You know, grocery store food prices is one of the big areas where prices really went up. You know, we hear a lot in the news also about gold, and gold soars. It has closed 18.3 on April 9. I should clarify the date. On April 9 of this year, gold closed 18.3% above its 200-day moving average and 11.6% above the 50-day moving average. And both readings were in, you know, the 95th percentile, meaning one of the highest of any period. Now, are we recommending gold? Absolutely not. Is it an alternative investment? Yes. Could it be something that you could diversify a portfolio with? Yes. But, you know, it has to fit your individual situation. But that's just a little bit of news on precious metals and specifically gold.
I want to clarify, because you said that quite strongly. We are not recommending gold. We're not saying you should or shouldn't buy gold.
That's
we just
right.
don't know if it's right for you. It is an alternative investment that has helped keep pace with inflation. Want to find out if it's right for you? Give us a call and we'd love to sit down and chat with you. Sorry, Carrie, you just said it so strong. I wanted to soften that just
soften
a touch.
Well,
let's continue with gold. This is interesting. I did not know this.
You didn't? I've read a lot of articles on this.
I had recently, but I didn't know it began last year already. Costco, which again, not recommending that stock as well, because we don't know if it's a good fit for you. Maybe it is. Costco began selling 1 ounce gold bars online in 2023. Wells Fargo analyst estimates that Costco is now selling between, this is a big range, I don't know why they gave such a big range, but selling between $100 and $200 million worth of 1 ounce gold bars each month.
Yeah.
That's a big number. On April 10, Costco reported net sales for the, I believe this was for the quarter, $23.5 billion just for the quarter. Not a surprise if you visit a local Costco in the area. That parking lot is packed from the minute they open to the minute they close every single day.
Yeah,
every day. Sales were up 9.4% for the first quarter compared to the previous quarter. So they continue to find ways to increase that revenue.
They have found a niche.
Good company.
They do well.
They have done well.
They have. And again, we should tell our listeners we're not wrecking Costco as buying and investing in it. It's just we're reporting the news here.
And just a reminder why we always have to say that every show. We're just not allowed to make recommendations over the radio because everyone's situation's different, and what might be a good fit for one person may not be a good fit for another person.
Exactly.
So that's why we always clarify.
17 years and counting, the tech sector in the S&P 500 is currently above 29%. So 29% of the S&P 500 is made up of tech, which is 4 percentage points larger than the weighting of the smallest six sectors combined. You know, technology has now been the biggest sector in the S&P 500 for the 17 consecutive years.
That's just not a surprise. I mean, everything tech is in everything. So it's just not a surprise that the vast majority of the weighting of that particular index is tech companies. Let's see here. Do we got another one? According to the IRS, 19.4 million people out of 146 million taxpayers requested an extension. So that's interesting. So about 20 million people requested an extension out of the 146 million taxpayers.
You know, I hear this often from Jack in the past, and he always talks about when he went to college, secure and get an internship. And studies have shown that 49% of male, 44% of female college graduates are still working at below college level jobs 10 years after graduation. Now, graduates who complete an internship are 49% less likely to become underemployed. So get that internship.
Yeah, we're going to have to take a break in a minute, but we've talked about that at our women's seminar that more and more, I think females are are coming out of college with more degrees now than men. Mm-hmm. What am I trying to say? I think there's more females attending college these days than men, based on some statistics we're reading off for our women's seminar. But we got to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to move into two listener questions we've got and then jump into our show. We have 10 facts you should know about Social Security. We will be right back with more Money Matters.
Listeners, welcome back on this Saturday morning. We're going to be talking about 10 things you should know about Social Security, but we also have questions from our listeners and from clients throughout the week that have come into our office or called us, and we put these on the air as just a good resource to know, one, what other people are asking. And there's probably more people that would ask the question, and we want to pass on the answers to the people out there that listen.
So, Carrie, before we ask the first question, it has to do with 529s, and they have a great question, but most people might be surprised to know this. Beginning this year, if you have a 529, so that's a college savings account. So a 529 is just a name for a type of investment account, and that type of investment account is a 529, which is designed to be used for education. It can be used for private school from K through 12, or for most people, they save in a 529 for college. Why do they use a 529? Because your investments grow tax-free. As long as you use it for school, you can take all that growth out tax-free, which is really nice. So just for example, can't guarantee this, but if someone can get about a 8 to 10% return per year, $50 a month for 18 years should work out to about 20 grand. Well, in a 529 used for college, don't have to pay taxes on mm-hmm. all the gains. So it's yep. a great investment tool that the IRS is allowing for people to help save for college. Now, new rule that came about, I'm going to flip this over to Carrie. If you don't end up using your 529 for college, what is the new rule out there, new option out there yeah. that you have? Yeah. And then that will lead into the listener question.
Well, yeah, the new rule out there allows people that still have money in 529 plans after 15 years to convert this 529 plan over to a Roth IRA for that beneficiary.
Which is awesome because Roths also grow tax-free and can be used later on for retirement tax-free. So the question that we got from our listener, what are the tax penalties on a 529 if I convert it to a Roth? And Carrie, we'll let you answer that question.
Well, Brent, great question here. There are no penalties now of converting the 529 to a Roth IRA.
No, absolutely not. It's an awesome opportunity. This came about with Secure Act 2.0, and this is the first year we were able to do that. Carrie, I think I could be wrong. I'm sorry to ask you this on the air, but did you help someone do this already?
Yes, I'm in the process of helping somebody do this.
So our first client, converting yeah. 529 to Roth.
Yep.
Awesome.
They had some extra money that they didn't use in college because their daughter had some grants, scholarships mm-hmm. that covered a big chunk, and they had extra money, so we're gradually converting it. You can only do so much a year.
There is a limit. Good point. Yeah. You can only do up to $35,000, and right now I believe you can do up to $7,000 per year.
Per year yep. for a maximum of $35,000. And so we're going to gradually do this with this client of ours. And now she's going to have her own Roth, and she can take this money out in the future for retirement tax-free.
Love it. Absolutely love it. I'm so glad they did that because we would meet with young parents, and they would say, I'm just concerned because what if I put all this money in the 529 and my child does not go to college? Now they have an alternative option of switching it to Roth. So very thankful for that. The government did something right for the people. For the people. All right, next question. What are the essential steps for starting a successful retirement savings plan for newlyweds? Great question. We actually had a show about this a couple weeks ago, so they must have missed that show. So we'll quick touch on that. But that's a good lead-in, too. If you've missed previous shows and want to catch up, you can listen to our podcast by, I believe, either going to WHTC's website or, of course, our website, CooleyGodfrey.com, and you can listen to past episodes. But again, what are the essential steps for starting a successful retirement saving plan for newlyweds? You know, a big thing is open communication. You got to be – a lot of times one person takes the lead and the other person's kind of in the dark. That really just doesn't work that well. Start out with open communication and have a discussion about what do finances mean to each other. Talk about what are your financial goals. Talk about how you feel about debt, credit card use, car loans, how much should you have in a home mortgage. I mean, talk about all those things so that you both have an understanding of how each other's brains work as it comes to money. And then from there, love to say this word, budget. A budget is so key, because then you know, well, how much do we need to cover our bills and some of the things we want to do? How much do we have left over? And then with that money that's left over, that's the money that gets divided up into different strategies to fund the different financial goals. Could be retirement, could be a house, could be a car, travel, a second home. Budget is what we need to know how much money do we have to work with to start setting money aside for whatever the financial goals are. So those are just a couple things. Mm-hmm. Hey, if you're about to get married or recently married, schedule an appointment with us. There's no cost to meet with us. Maybe people wonder, well, how do these guys get compensated? We get compensated from people that end up becoming clients, opening an account, and invest money with us. That's the long and short of it. We can give you much more detail on that if you meet with us. No cost to meet with us. I guarantee you'll walk away with some value that you can take and apply to your life, and maybe you'll end up deciding, hey, we want to work with these guys to help meet our financial goals.
Yeah, and a little thing I want to stick in there with that answer, you know, with newlyweds and anybody out there, you know, if you're working at a job and that employer matches you with, if you put in so much into your retirement plan, they'll match you. You know, whether you're young, old, newlywed, whoever you are, you need to make sure you're taking advantage of getting that, what we call that free money. If your employer is willing to match, you need to put in money to get the match. So get the free money.
I like the sound of free money, Carrie. All right, Carrie, let's start to dive into this week's topic. Things you need to know about Social Security. So I'm just going to do one more plug. We're not really going to start advertising this heavily yet because it's a ways away. But last year we did our first, I shouldn't say my first, I'm sure Carrie and Jack did them previously, but we did my first Social Security workshop. And I think we had about 100-125 people show up. The workshop was designed for people that are nearing or about ready, nearing the age to where they might want to start taking Social Security. So we bring in a speaker to that. Last year, we brought in an employee of the Social Security office. This year, we're bringing in a Social Security expert from a company called MFS. And this guy goes all around the U.S. doing these seminars. Mm-hmm. Very, very knowledgeable. We secured this person. Very excited. Not going to be till September 26th. So we will start advertising more for that as we get closer to that.
Yeah.
But we have people starting to already reserve. So because we're talking about Social Security today, we just want to mention that. September 26th, 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. Going to have a great guest speaker. Going to serve dessert because we're hosting this one kind of after dinner. Yeah. So it's not like some of our other dinner ones. So this will be a dessert evening about learning and prepping for starting your Social Security benefits. So sorry, that was a long, quick plug for that. But if you're sitting there going, I want to sign up for that because I don't want to miss out on my opportunity, you can call our office, 616-931-1223. Or you can shoot us an email, CooleyGodfrey@LPL.com. Carrie, things people should know about Social Security.
Yeah.
Why don't you kick us off?
Well, let's start off with find your Social Security full retirement age. Now, what I mean by that is people can, when they retire, or, you know, we should clarify this, retirement and Social Security are kind of two different things. You can retire any age you want to, but you can start to take Social Security as early as age 62. But over the years, the government has raised what they call the full Social Security age, which is now 67 for most of us. Now, if you're born and you're a little bit older, your full retirement age may be 66 and 8 months, or maybe 66 and 4 months. But what I mean by full retirement age is that you'll get, if you start taking Social Security at 62, it's going to be a 30% reduction from your full Social Security age and the amount you receive each month. So by waiting, your amount goes up each year. Now, I've even had this, Brent. People say, well, if I start taking it at 62 and then I reach my full Social Security age, won't it go up to that number? No, it doesn't. It depends on when you start, and that's your number you start at.
Yeah, so I'm going to add a little bit to that. So, yeah, Carrie's 100% right. For almost everyone now that hasn't collected yet, full retirement age is 67. Here's the key you need to know and why full retirement age is such an important age to know. If you said at age 62, I want to start taking Social Security, you can make about $23,000 a year and get your Social Security benefit. But once you cross over that $23,000, so if you still have a full-time job, you're making, you know, $40,000-$50,000 plus, you would never start Social Security at 62, because for every $2 over that approximate, it's approximate $23,000. For every $2 over, they're going to reduce your benefit by a dollar. So if you're making, like I said, if you're making well over $23,000 a year, you would never start taking Social Security at 62. Why full retirement age is so important at age, we're going to call it 67, because that's for most people now, at age 67, you can make as much money as you want. So you, if you're still working and don't want to retire and you're making $75,000-$80,000 a year, you can continue to make that and get your full Social Security benefit. That's the key for full retirement age. If you collect any year before full retirement age, you can make about $23,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. Let's quick cover one more point before we go to break here, Brent. People become eligible for Social Security benefits by working, okay? And Social Security looks at getting 40 credits over your career, so you can get 4 credits per year for times that you worked, and so in 10 years you can have your 40 credits. Now, what I say by that mean by that is now you're eligible. You're in the game to get Social Security. And credits are earned annually based on income. And now, so it takes 10 years to get those 40 credits.
And it doesn't have to be 10 consecutive years. You could start working for a few years, and then maybe you're out of the workforce for a little while. Could be to stay home with children, could be medical absence. But just to be able to qualify for Social Security, you have to, over the course of your lifetime, at least work 10 years. And we have to take a break, and we'll come back and move into, well, then how is Social Security calculated? So we will be right back with more Money Matters and talking about things you should know about Social Security.
And welcome back, listeners. Brent, we are talking about Social Security and 10 things you should know. And right before the break, we talked about full Social Security retirement age, which now for most of us is age 67. And then the other thing we talked about is being eligible to receive Social Security that you need 40 credits. What's next on the list?
Which is equivalent to 10 years of working. So then the next question people might ask, well, how is my Social Security benefit calculated? Everyone's Social Security benefit's different. It's based on how much income you made over your work career. Social Security will take the highest 35 years of your wages and just average them together to come up with a number. Well, what if you didn't work 35 years? What if you only worked the 10 years? What they'll do then, if you only worked 10 years, they're going to give you zeros for the remaining 25 years to calculate their average. So someone who's only worked 10 years is going to have far less Social Security benefit than someone who's worked the full 35 years. And someone who makes way more money is going to have a higher benefit than someone who makes less money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it is a function of how much money you make. So that's important. I want to mention this. Business owners, there's a fair amount of small business owners that don't pay themselves much of a wage, but maybe take distributions from the company. When you do that, you're not contributing to Social Security. And so then someday when you go to file for Social Security, you're kind of surprised when, hey, I made all this money in the business. Why am I not getting much Social Security? So you business owners got to really think through how much wage should they be paying themselves to also benefit from future Social Security.
Yeah, people get audited too. Social Security looks at that if you're self-employed and you're paying yourself a low wage, which means you're paying less into Social Security, but you're taking big draws and not paying Social Security on that. That could be an audit issue too down the road. And sometimes they can get after small business owners that way. Here's another important thing to remember. Let's say you continue to work after 67 and you're collecting Social Security. One thing that happens is each year that you continue to work, your Social Security is recalculated, meaning that if your current year of work is higher than one that you worked 30 years ago, they're going to drop the lower one and add the higher one. So it does get recalculated to the higher amount.
So the next thing to know that once you do start collecting Social Security, you are eligible for an annual cost of living adjustment. They've abbreviated that to call it COLA, kind of like Coca-Cola, C-O-L-A. But that just stands for cost of living adjustment. It comes out every October. The Social Security office will announce what the increase is. And in January, your first payment in January, you see the increase. Now, they have not always increased Social Security. With the high inflation we had the last couple of years, we've seen some pretty big increases. But for the previous decade, inflation was very, very low, and increases could be very minimal to maybe sometimes they won't even increase it if there wasn't inflation. So not guaranteed that you're going to get a set increase, but there is an increase, which does help combat inflation. So we talked about full retirement age being 67, but Carrie, what if someone decided not to take it at 67? When do they have to take it by, and what happens from 67 until that age?
Yeah, exactly. So kind of falling back a little bit on what we talked about briefly earlier, you know, claiming benefits before your full retirement age does lead to a permanent reduction in those monthly benefits. Now, waiting to claim those benefits until age 70 increases that monthly benefit by approximately 8% annually, which with included COLAs, as you talked about, cost of living increases. And delaying those benefits can also boost survivor benefits, providing financial security for the surviving spouse. So for example, if husband and wife and one of them works full-time, the other one has worked part-time, well, the full-time person is going to have a lot higher benefit in Social Security. Now, when one of those people pass away of that couple, the surviving spouse gets the highest of the two Social Security. So a strategy there is having one person wait to let that number grow leaves the surviving spouse with a higher amount, which can help in retirement and increase costs over the years.
So what about, I guess I'm going to ask myself the question because it's my turn.
Well, I can ask the question.
Well, I was going to lead into it. We talked about the fact that in order to qualify Social Security, you have to at least work 10 years. But many times for married couples, sometimes one of the spouses doesn't work 10 years. They decided it was important to have one of the spouses stay home and raise the kids. And now kids are out of the house. They're, you know, in the Social Security age, but they didn't get their 10 years in. Well, the Social Security offers something called a spousal benefit. So if one of the spouses did not meet that 10-year requirement, that does not exclude them from being able to get Social Security. There's a spousal benefit where a spouse can get up to 50% of the other spouse's Social Security benefit. So let's just say a spouse did work 10 years, but their amount was less than half of their spouse's, you also get bumped up to 50% of the spouse's. So it's a nice benefit out there to make sure that a married couple, the other spouse, has the opportunity to at least collect up to half of the other spouse's. Now, if you decide to take it early, same thing apply. If you take it at 62 versus full retirement age, it does get discounted again. So it may not be exactly 50% of your spouse's depending on when you take it.
Now, there are some benefits, pensions out there, that might reduce Social Security benefits in the future.
This is very, very rare, so we don't want to scare anyone. But it has happened. We've seen it with some pastors.
Yep, railroad
some,
workers.
We've seen it with some government workers, yeah.
So,
but very rare, so I don't want to scare anybody.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So pensions from non-Social Security covered jobs can impact those benefits through provisions in what was called by the government the windfall elimination provision and government pension offset. So it mostly deals with government employees, and especially it's common with railroad workers, because when you apply for Social Security, that's a common question.
Well, you'll know if you're if this would impact you or not. So there are certain jobs where if there's a pension attached to that job, there's certain jobs where you can elect to contribute to Social Security or not elect to add to Social Security. And perfect example, I had a pastor that had the option of contributing to Social Security. You know what? I don't think he was a pastor at that time, actually. I think he was in another job. It might have been a governmental job. But he had the option to elect to have part of his paycheck go to Social Security or not. He elected to not. And then when it came time to get Social Security, he kind of forgot about it. And when he thought his benefit was going to be like $2,500 a month, ended up being like $600 a month. Totally caught off guard, impacted his retirement strategy. And so it can come to a surprise. Very few people are impacted by this. You would know because you were asked, do you want to contribute to Social Security or do you not? And if you think, I kind of want to have a Social Security benefit later on, well, then you should choose the option to contribute to Social Security.
Exactly. And, you know, just kind of highlighting your story too, I had a pastor client over the years who passed away, and he didn't pay into Social Security. And what he did not do was save enough into investments, which left his spouse with very little. So you need to think about those impacts long term when declining Social Security or to apply and take Social Security in the future as far as paying into the system.
Gary, what if a spouse passes away or a parent passes away? Is there any type of Social Security benefit for survivors?
Yes, there is. So surviving spouses, and we need to add this, eligible children can receive benefits based on the deceased earnings record. Now, the children need to be under a certain age to get that. You know, age at claiming affects, you know, the benefit amounts, just like with anything, with options for early claiming with reduced benefits or delayed claiming for higher payouts.
Right. So for a survivor benefit to a spouse, you can start collecting it as early as age 60. Again, it's discounted by age 60. But if you have children in the house under age 18, they can start getting a benefit right away until they're 18.
Until they're 18.
If you find yourself in that situation and you have not reached out to Social Security office, please reach out to us. We've had examples. We've used them on the show before where we've had widowed people start taking the spousal benefit at age 60 while they let their own Social Security benefit continue to increase. And then for some of them, they're waiting till age 70, and then they're going to flip to their own, which will have increased quite a bit more during that time. So there's things we can help you with there if you find yourself in a widowed position.
Yeah, and we should also let know, so if that person becomes widowed and then, you know, gets remarried after their first spouse's death, it can affect benefit eligibility and payment amounts down the road, because it depends on how long you're married. And when you got remarried and what your benefit's based off of, it's going to be usually your current spouse.
Divorce happens. And if you, and this is all too common, where you'll have had a couple married for 20, 25, 30 years, had children, and all of a sudden children are out of the house, and the couple kind of looks at each other and, I don't know you anymore, and they decide to go their separate ways. Well, many times we've had these situations occur where one of the spouses stayed home with the kids, they weren't working, and they don't have the Social Security benefit that the other spouse has. If you are divorced, you still have the ability to get the spousal benefit, which was to claim up to 50% of the amount of the other spouse's Social Security. So if for some reason, again, you didn't work over those years, your ex-spouse is collecting Social Security at $3,000, you could be eligible up to $1,500, 50% of the other person's benefit. And so something to know out mm-hmm. there if you're divorced, finding yourself in that situation.
Here's something a lot of people don't know about, Brent, is you can actually undo Social Security benefits, the decision, but you can only do it in the first 12 months. So within the first 12 months of claiming your Social Security benefits, individuals have the opportunity to withdraw their application and restart benefits later. Now, why would you want to do that? Let's say you're continuing to work, you don't need the money, you undo it, you can let your future benefits grow and be a higher amount in the future. So sometimes a strategy of restarting it could work in your favor long term.
We already got to go. That's the end of the show. If you have not created an account at ssa.gov, you need to do that. Next week's topic, Guide to Retirement. Thank you for listening to Money Matters with Brent Kerwecker
and Carrie Cooley. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Money Matters on 99.7 and 1450 WHTC. If you need help with your personal financial needs or goals, please call us at 616-931-1223 or Google Cooley Godfrey Investment Group in Zeeland. The opinions voiced in this show are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investment or investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, and financial advisor or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. Join us next week for Money Matters on 99.7 and 1450 WHTC.